Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Darren Kaster, in studio again with Stefan Hostetter and Sabine Hassetti. I'm going to be taking a charge point, as it were, on our interview this week, which is with Matthew Kleppenstein. He is a EV and electronic vehicle expert in the sense that he produces reports on market trends, as well as just generally keeping up to date on the electrification industry. And we will likely, by extension of that, also talk a little bit about the oil industry as well. So vehicle focus as far as my interview today, that will be in the middle of the program. However, Stefan and Sabina are going to be taking charge on the news portion, and I will hand it off right now to Stefan for your first section of news.
Thank you so much. So I'm actually leaving much of the part three of our ongoing 208-part series of Resisting Trump to Sabina today. So instead, I am covering the ever, ever interesting and attractive conversation of power, and not the fun kind of like political power, which we often talk about, but, you know, just the more nitty gritty. So, you know, investments in solar and so where our Canadian economy can be going. Bear with me. I promise it's very important, if not the not the most attractive of topics, because there's sort of three coinciding stories, all of which have lend themselves to sort of one overall conversation, which is really what we will be doing as Canadians over the next 10, 20 years about where our economy is going, and then what that means in the short term in regards to how we react with the Trump presidency, and also in the long term of where we see our economy being powered in the next 10, 20, 30 years. So, to begin with, you know, Darren in the past has already highlighted the fact that Trudeau has come out and said that we need to start phasing out, that we need to at some point phase out the oil sands. Which, again, if you understand climate science, is a very innocuous sentence. Arguably, it's an innocuous sentence if you understand that he left the timelines as open as humanly possible.
I just want to note really quickly that like that's in the sense of that like we're going to die someday.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At some point the oil sands will have no oil, so theoretically we'll have to shut them down. There's hopefully a slightly faster timeline than that. But basically that conversation, at least, you know, to some extent that was said by a prime minister, which is honestly, which at least puts him slightly to the left of many of the oil companies who are basically claiming that oil can last forever. There isn't actually, you know, it's very, very rare to find a head of an oil company who's willing to say that oil will not last forever.
Yeah, Justin Trudeau is literally saying the equivalent of the sky is blue, and this is what's considered like progressive and lefty.
Yeah.
Yet another notch in the belt of facts of a well-known liberal bias.
So what's interesting about that is that, you know, we've talked a bunch before on the show about how much the where oil will end up and sort of, because everyone's just basically betting on when peak oil will happen. It's a matter of reality that at some point there will be less oil in the ground than oil we're currently burning, and therefore it has to happen at some point. And yet it seems consistently that the goal is really to see how long we can push that out rather than actually figuring out how to transition. But to move on, there's these three stories that I want to go one by one to highlight exactly where this is going. And the first is an interesting, very short little article from National Observer about the former Exxon boss, Rex Tillerson, in which after a short meeting with Chrystia Freeland, she said that he will be good for Canada. The National Observer followed up followed up on with Chrystia Freeland and the Government of Canada to find out if any part of that conversation included the words climate change, and did not get a response by the time that this was posted or that we've aired. So as we stand now, we don't know what the context of good for Canada is, but you know, when you're talking about the former boss of Exxon and whether or not he's going, what he means for Canada and the economy and everything else, you can't help but think that what she's referencing, of course, is pipelines. You know, she, Tillerson, is in the position to determine whether or not the Keystone XL pipeline goes through, and many other sort of infrastructure projects of that nature, as long as they cross the border or the border of the United States. And so, when you say someone's going to be good for Canada, all we hear is what you're saying is that that oil is going to be a big part of Canada's future, and we need to keep investing in it, and that's what the support is. That's the way it's read by us, I guess I'll say. Now, I want to take a second to call out that at this point, one thing that we often don't give we don't lend ourselves too often to on the show, or in reality, the world itself doesn't lend, is the idea that politicians can just be scared. And in part, when I read this, a bit of me wondered if the quote unquote good for Canada was that Chrystia Freeland sat down with Rex Tillerson and he was like, "Don't worry, Trump won't do anything too ridiculous." And that was the entire conversation. Because the way that some of the comments that she says, this one quote is "I want to underscore that Secretary Tillerson is someone who knows Canada very well and in particular has a very strong understanding of the mutual benefits of the Canada-US relationship, and I think will be a good partner for us." I just want to highlight the idea of the word mutual there, because earlier this week, Trump hung up on about six different world leaders, Trump hung up on Australia last week. I believe this week he bowed to the power of China and accepted the One China policy, and then told Putin that he didn't like the Russia deal because that was a bad deal that Obama had decided. So there is a part of me wants to understand this in a larger context of, you know, when you're dealing with someone like Trump, just having a rational conversation with a human in his administration must feel at least a little bit secure, must feel a little bit better. Now, again, that is not to say that that this is a statement we would that I'm really stoked to hear about, given the fact that this conversation can only really be understood and heard through this lens of pipelines. So moving on to the second conversation, which is another article from the Vancouver Observer, which is titled "How Trump May Spur Canada to Up Its Game on Climate Change." And again, what's interesting about this is it's kind of aspirational, the article. It's not actually saying that we're actually going to do that. It's more saying like, hey, maybe being scared of Trump will mean we'll do something. And so, like, yes, that would be great. And, you know, we have set in place some things that could lead to that sort of effort. But in terms of actual things we've done, very similarly, actually, to the sort of, you know, pleasant tweets Justin Trudeau has tweeted out about accepting more refugees while also accepting no more refugees. This sort of idea of like, maybe something good will happen, even though bad things are currently happening, is a, you know, isn't the most convincing of reasons to feel good about the world right now. This idea that, you know, that we need a better, stronger reaction from our government into response to worse action from other people is aspirational until we actually see some real action. So, you know, the next Trudeau budget comes out pretty soon, and I sincerely hope that we might see some of that actual sort of uptick of action. One of the ways that this highlighted that we could actually help foster this is actually by selling a lot of our renewable energy actually into the states. Some jurisdictions in Canada already do that. But again, that sort of Canada is a microcosm of the amount of energy required by the United States. So yes, we can help green some places, or at least like some of our excess hydro can go into, you know, can maybe offset some coal plants and stuff like that. Now, of course, it should be recognized that hydro is great after it's built, but is incredibly problematic while it's being built in many places. See the Site C Dam for as a reference point for that, and especially when you understand full cost carbon. You know, once it's running, yes, that's great, but that's, you know, if you clear cut of multiple forests and dammed an ecosystem, the actual carbon benefit is much harder to understand. Which again is part of actually this larger conversation, understanding of power and of energy, I guess, and how its climate benefits are. You know, every reaction to every solar panel is, well, what's its full cost accounting, and everything like that. And so every one of these is so site specific that the conversation needs to be deeper than just it's renewable or not.
Yeah, and I just want to jump in. Like, this is a really important point when it's coming to when we're talking about like public policy, just like generally, right? Because the full cost accounting is something that is almost never done. Like, conceptually, as far as like a policy area, this isn't like part of the decision making process, right? There's no standard council for full cost accounting of policies. There's no equivalent of the Office of Government Ethics or something like that, or any of those economic review panels that the Americans have. I'm not aware. I apologize my ignorance here. I'm not aware if Canada has anything equivalent. But in neither country is there any equivalent where any of this goes through any scientist, right? So the next time you're reading an article or you're here listening to some right wing politician and they're giving you this arrogant, condescending sneer about idealistic environmentalists, sure, all this kissing frogs stuff is really, really nice, but at the end of the day, this is what's best for Canada, is they don't know that. And telling them and pointing out to them that they've never done the accounting and that they can't even make that statement, that even if we accept all of their arguments, that the conclusion does not follow from the evidence submitted, is because they haven't done the work, right? That in itself, the fact that this full cost accounting hasn't been done is not evidence that they're wrong. But they have yet to present evidence that they're right, and that's the important part, because they're looking to make policy based on, at best, guesses.
Yeah, and I think there's a level of work being done on particular places to understand different pieces of full cost accounting, but again, full cost accounting is also really, really difficult. You know, it's one of those things where even if you do it comes down to the sort of understanding of trying to actually figure out the complexities of this world, which we fully accept that we can't do. You know, for a long time, a response to how to protect the environment was to try to understand the monetary benefit of all of these different parts of the environment, which then comes down to the central fact of that we just don't know enough about our natural world to be able to do this. And you get to a point where, at some point people are scared of these conversations, I think, because at some point you get too big and you get into, metaphysics and ethics to some extent, At some point it's like, well, what is the price point you put on making an entire species go extinct? What is the price point of increasing acidity in the oceans to an extent in which it's uninhabitable for many of these things? And then what is the price point of ultimately making our world uninhabitable, which is the ultimate question, right? There's, it's funny because the quote unquote a consistent detraction, I guess, on the environmental movement is that we're not serious, or we don't understand the seriousness of business. And to be fair, the environmental movement is rife with misunderstanding, economics, misunderstanding different interactions, even our own interactions with the natural world. The number of the vaccination denying people who exist who probably agree with me on pipelines is massive, and that's just a fact. And the amount that we are rife with the naturalistic fallacy of presuming that just quote unquote nature is better is equal as well. And so I'm not trying to say here that the environmentalists don't have their flaws, but I think more often than not, that all environmentalists get painted with this brush of not understanding economics or not understanding the quote-unquote serious parts of this conversation.
Yeah, and just one really quick thing on that as well is that it's really, really important, right? And so, yeah, I mean, the individuals making the arguments aren't important. Right. Mm-hmm. That's an argument from authority. It works the other way around, too. You can't dismiss someone's argument because they don't. The arguments stand or fall on their own merits. Right. The person presenting them is irrelevant. I don't care if it's Albert Einstein or the guy who made my, bad coffee this morning. It doesn't matter. The arguments stand and fall on its own merits. But here's where that full cost accounting thing, because it's really important, Stefan, that you pointed this out. Full cost accounting is incredibly hard to do, and nigh potentially in some cases next to impossible to do completely. But here's the important point, right? And so what people will tell you is, well, we can't proceed with decision making if we have to full cost accounting everything. Fair point. Here's the counter argument, though. When we're looking at things like renewable energy versus oil, there's a degree of unknowns, right? There are a number of unknowns when we do, for instance, a big push on doing renewable energy. We have a lot more certainty about the economics of both of those things. But the environmental downsides are exponentially more when we start playing with the Russian roulette of climate change, right? So, yes, we cannot have perfect information in either case. But in one case, there's a hell of a lot more unknowns, and that makes it exponentially more possible that something could go wrong. And that's the cost-benefit analysis. That's the risk assessment, is the number of unknowns and the degree of damage if you're wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's the – and there's that part of that conversation, and the part of understanding full cost accounting leads to this point in which you get to a point where, because you can't speak authoritatively, because – a big part of this is understanding our limitations of understanding, you get swept under the rug because you end up having to be like, you end up opening the conversation to these wider conversations of like, at some point we have to not have oil. And it's like, well, that's not an answer to what the problem is. And you're like, that's true, but that doesn't mean that that's not still the problem that we actually have to face. You know, just saying that your future world is less certain than my current world isn't a useful argument about where we stand, which leads me finally to a mildly depressing but I think actually ultimately important to face and then have a conversation about article once again from the National Observer. I stole three from them this week, but why Canada's clean energy investment plummeted in 2016. And so this is for the second consecutive year that investment in renewable energy or clean energy, dropped. This year it went down. It was down by 46% in 2016 to $2.4 billion U.S. And it's the lowest point since 2005. However, and that headline is one of those things that would be, you know, thrown up on Breitbart as like clean energy sector dying, climate change hoax solved by Trump. But what's interesting is then you read to the people who actually know what they're talking about, and there's a much different conversation. You know, industry stakeholders are not actually scared of this, not surprised at least in this decrease, mainly because the wind energies were being built on the basis of long-term power purchase agreements, and some of those are signed and then built and now more have to be built, signed and built later again, right? And so there's level of which. It's not that like suddenly a ton of people stopped trying to buy renewable energy. It's just that a lot of the different ways pricing went happened. And so we, being trying to do due diligence, knowing our limitations of not fully understanding what this might mean, reached out to our resident economist, Tim Nash, to get a quote from him about what he sort of his understood about this renewable investment drop. And this is his quote. Big point here is that the global capacity is up. It's getting so cheap and so fast that money isn't necessarily the best measure of growth in renewables. With demand lower than supply in Ontario, I'd expect to see heavier investments in utility-scale storage, like HydroStore, in the coming years. And with revenues from cap and trade coming in, I'd also expect to see some R&D rise into things that increase demand for electricity, like electric cars and off-grid renewable energy systems for northern communities. And what's interesting about that and important to mention about that is, the stats back them up in that actually installation remains to be increasing despite the fact that the actual invested money is decreasing, which in part means that we're just – that if as it gets cheaper, that can happen. But also what's important to note is that one big part of the renewable energy future is dramatically more efficient appliances and utilities. And so we should expect and hope to see actually demand decrease to some extent rather than increase. Or rather, we can't expect constantly growth. That's part of what the whole conversation is here about the economy generally is we can't expect never-ending growth, although I did write a five-part piece that Tim suggested to, implying that maybe we could in a very weird way that we wouldn't really understand as we go along. However, that is our energy update for the time being. I'm going to throw it to our tech today to both introduce the song we're listening
to. All right, we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm going to be speaking now to Matthew Klippenstein, who is joining us to talk about ostensibly electric vehicles. Welcome to The Green Majority, Matthew.
Thanks again, Darren. Great to be back.
Now, Matthew, we've had you on the phone before to talk about this topic, and in my attempt to read the mountain of links that you sent this morning, I forgot to actually copy my link of your introduction. So would you please cover for my oversight and more properly introduce yourself and your background?
Sure, yeah, no worries. My name is Matthew Klippenstein. I'm a chemical engineer turned a renewable energy consultant, and I've also chronicled the Canadian electric vehicle scene for greencarreports.com for the past, I guess, four or five years, something like that. I have a database, a Google document, basically, that anyone can access if they want to check out the stats on a monthly basis, and that's at tinyurl.com/CanadaEVSales.
Awesome.
And it's basically my effort to make some of this data transparent because, you know, it's useful, and it's nice to be able to check in on these things if that's what... if that's what tickles your fancy, and it happens to tickle mine.
Well, and we'll, of course, and any information and all the links you send me, whether we get to them or not, including the link to that report, will be available on the show post as well later at greenmajority.ca. But we have a bunch of stuff we want to talk to. As I said, you sent me a mountain of information. I want to try and get to as much of it as humanly possible.
Absolutely.
I think the best place to start is actually the thing I want to talk about the least, not because it's not important, but just because I think it frames the conversation. So just really quickly, because I think it puts the rest of what we're going to talk about into context, can you talk about that link that you sent, the last one, which is about the bloodbath continuing for the oil industry? So what's going on with the other part of the sector?
Sure. So on the energy side, the oil industry has had a tough few years. It has been a bloodbath financially. Readers can follow up on the link. But basically what's happened is that the you know, revenues for the super majors, the Seven Sisters, as sometimes called, are down because the oil price is down. However, in the interest of propping up the stock price to keep up, you know, executive compensation with stock options and so forth, to keep up dividends, the oil companies are basically spending more money than they're earning in profits now. And there doesn't seem to be any indication that that's going to turn around quickly. Even if the oil price goes up marginally or somewhat, they've still committed themselves to these big fat dividends, which are basically stealing money away from reinvestment into their businesses. That's kind of a good thing overall because that means they're going to find less oil, they're going to invest less in exploiting or extracting from new resources, and that should ultimately help more capital find its way into the renewable energy sector. Basically, you know, for a guy like me, I grew up in the, I guess I was a teenager in the early 90s, you know, the first Kyoto Accord, so forth. This is a great sign where the fossil fuel sector is no longer ridiculously profitable, and now you know is basically pushing uphill to try and make its way in the world. And every year that this continues to happen is another year that renewables can continue to grow and continue to surge and develop even more advantages over the fossil counterparts.
So the overall story here is that the renewables are continuing to penetrate the Canadian market, but of course the market itself fluctuates. So can you talk about the growth of renewables relative to the overall market itself, what, as far as the market share of this part of the product line?
Sure. So what's important to recognize is that the energy usage in the world is roughly divided into three parts. One is electricity. One is transportation, one is heat. And on the transportation side, it's really slow in terms of switching over to batteries and so forth. Oil will have a role for many years to come. On the electricity side is where it's most exciting because we have many coal plants being shut down. many of them have been replaced by natural gas, but still renewables are growing. You know, Bill Gates is fond of quoting this University of Manitoba professor of Vaclav Smil, I think it is. And this fellow has said that, oh, it takes like 30 years for new technology to become, to get 1% of electric generation around the world. And, you know, wind and solar have completely blasted by that and demonstrated that that's simply not a relevant comparison to make anymore. So growth has been continuing. It's slowed a little bit as the industries have gotten larger. I'll just try and pull up the stats on total electricity generation, but they are fantastic. And the energy return on investment for solar and for wind is now better than the energy return on investment for new oil discoveries, which is significant. It again demonstrates that all the momentum, all the improvements are in renewables. Sail, as it were. It's a nice, great tailwind, and that will help us transition, you know, hopefully as fast as possible, to a more renewable world as opposed to one which is based on and dependent on fossil resources.
Now, Matthew, one of the interesting parts in your reports and some of the articles that you linked, of course, was that you know, one of the countries you compared to was Norway, which has significantly better penetration of their EV market. And when I was reading a little farther down, one of the interesting things that I thought of that sort of related to that, because of course you go over that this is a product of a number of factors, but much having to do with their policy. They placed a levy, if you will, on gasoline, but it also has to do with the fact that they're just different consumers. I mean, people buy different cars generally in Europe, and so one of the other things that stuck out for me reading a little bit farther down was that you were looking forward to the release of the Ford F-150 as an EV vehicle, and I wanted to know how big an effect you think this might have on the market, because like I'm the least car person I know, and I know a lot of not very, you know, car people, and even I know what the F-150 is because it's such an iconic vehicle. Do you think this is going to have a huge impact on the market?
Sure. So just as a bit of background, Canada is probably sold its 30,000 plug-in electric vehicle cumulatively, probably in February. And that's 0.15% of our total overall electric fleet. Plug-in electric vehicles are maybe 0.5, 0.6% of the new car sales in Canada. They're about 1% in Quebec and BC and about 0.5% in Ontario and about 0% everywhere else. Norway, meanwhile, which has something like, you know, 15% of our population, has 135,000 plug-in cars. So they have like more than four and a half times our number. 5% of all cars on their roads now are plug-ins. And last year, something like 29% of all new car sales were plug-in electric vehicles. And you're right, it is a matter of policy. Norway used to be one of the poorest countries in Europe, poorest in Western Europe, rather. And so back in the day, being fairly collectivist-minded or community-minded, they said, well, we're going to put a luxury tax on cars, and because cars were luxury. And they found oil, and instead of, you know, lowering taxes and saying, hey, everyone, we're gonna spend and fritter away all this largesse. We're going to save some money. It'll give us options for later. And what they've been able to do is they've said, well, look, you know, we want to export all the oil we make. We don't want to consume it because we can make more money selling it. And there's an environmental interest as well. And so electric vehicles are exempt from the luxury tax and from the 25% GST equivalent that they have. And that has meant that Norway is a beautiful sort of a test bed or a beautiful case study where what happens if consumers have electric vehicles which are, you know, which are no more expensive than your average combustion vehicle. Surprise, surprise, people actually prefer the electric vehicles. So there are some other advantages as well, but I think the main one is that it isn't a big additional cost. Mm. And so they had some quite prudent and long-lasting public policy. They've had this since the 1990s, well before any major car maker was interested even in electric vehicles. And they've benefited from it. And now, you know, people, BC Hydro, here in British Columbia, I'm sure other utilities elsewhere in the world are trying to talk to them to say, hey, how do we figure out how to integrate more electric vehicles, which means consulting jobs for their experts. It's a real example of how being on the forefront of a technology allows you to generate a lot more benefits than you would think initially.
Yeah, never mind Justin Trudeau's recent comments that we were talking about just a few minutes ago, during Stefan's portion of the program. But never mind all the hoopla that happened when Justin Trudeau accidentally said a true thing, which is eventually we'll have to leave oil behind. I mean, if he came out and said anywhere near a reporter that cars were a luxury, they'd have burned him at the stake by now.
Oh, well, absolutely. And, you know, perhaps we've had a little bit easier in Canada. We have been a relatively wealthy country. There is a bit of geography as well, like yourselves. I'm an urban progressive leaning. I'm lucky enough to be a professional. I have relatives in the prairies in Saskatchewan. Very different world. They are F-150 drivers. And linking back to the importance of the F-150, it'll come out with a plug-in version in 2020. And the big opportunity there, I think, is that all of a sudden, all these conservative leaning, gun rack type people who are totally not from my political or cultural tribe, the exact opposite. Suddenly, hey, it's okay. It's not just these urban professional, fancy talking guys with Teslas. It's not these granola crunching Nissan Leaf drivers. Hey, it's like manly men who go out and shoot deer in the hunting season who also have plug-in vehicles. Since, as you said, the F-150 is like head and shoulders the number one selling vehicle in Canada, even if you get like a percent of them being plug-in electrics, that's still a massive number. That would basically make it pretty much the best-selling electric vehicle in Canada. And again, that's just because the F-150 is so dominant.
Mm. And another aspect there, and you'll have to correct me here because I'm going from memory and I might be incorrect, so please do correct me if I'm wrong here, but in many cases the electric version of a similar gas powered I don't know if this is universal or just in some select cases, but actually just plain performs better, because that's one of the common sort of arguments against electric vehicles is, well, I don't, just for the sake of saving the planet, I don't want to have a wimpy car that doesn't perform. But in many cases that is actually just false, is it not?
Yes. So I think electric cars suffer from what you might call the golf cart syndrome, where a lot of people first experience electric vehicles as golf carts, as very underpowered vehicles. Maybe they looked kind of funny. The original EV1 from GM from the 1990s had like two doors, looked like a spaceship. It looked kind of plasticky, not what people think a car should look like. But yes, electric vehicles are much better performing. They have more torque. They're more fun to drive. You do need to be able to plug in at home, but even there, there are policies that are being introduced which allow you, even as an apartment dweller, to be able to access electricity if you can, pay for the routing of the charger so the rest of your strata or the landlord doesn't bear the burden of the cost. Just to correct myself, Ford would have to sell maybe 3 or 4% of their F-Series trucks as plug-in hybrids to be able to be the number one. Chevy Bolt is doing very well, but yes, it is. They are better to drive, and I think that you'll see in this coming wave is that all the luxury makers, realizing that first off, Tesla has done the impossible. Full due credit to them. It's kind of kicked them in the pants, and they said, "Hey, we need to have our own products. We have luxury vehicles. We can afford the extra money to put in a bunch of batteries and a hybrid system if we want." And so they do. They do strongly imagine that a lot of their customers will be choosing electric vehicles, even without rebates, because it is a better drive ultimately.
Yeah, and so one of the last things, unfortunately, we only have about four, I can maybe stretch it to five because I left this conversation, minutes left. So I have two questions left, but I'd really rather spend the majority of it on the second one. So maybe we can try and shoehorn the first one as briefly as possible. But
sure.
Because you drilled so deep into the data here, Matthew, you have it broken down not just by manufacturer but by model. I'm very interested to know if from your analysis, does there seem to be more of a trend of for people who are Canadians who are making EV purchases? Does there seem to be more of a trend of brand loyalty or specific model loyalty? So what I mean is that are all the top performing cars all a certain type of car from a variety of manufacturers, or is there one specific manufacturer which seems to be attracting the most interest?
Okay, so clearly Chevy is the dominant manufacturer on the Canadian market. They sell maybe a third of the plug-in electric vehicles. Tesla also does quite well for itself. There may be not quite a quarter, maybe 20%, one in five. But I think the Chevy's dominance, and that dominance will increase as the Chevy Bolt has come out now. It's a Bolt as in Burnaby, not the Volt as in Vancouver. The Bolt is the all-electric vehicle. It beat Tesla to the market with a sub-$40,000 200-mile or 380-kilometer range in Canada here. I would have never thought growing up that General Motors would be like the leading environmentally friendly maker of electric vehicles or environmentally friendly vehicles, right? It was always Toyota or Honda or someone. But that is the world we live in. It's not just Donald Trump as president. It's GM as the big leader in Canada, at least, with electric vehicles. Globally, it is Nissan. They sold 250,000 Leafs, and they are fully committed to electric vehicles as well. A lot of that success seems to come from one dealership in Quebec, which has had tremendous success. I'm sure you want to get on to your other questions, so perhaps I'll send in a couple links that people can read to. But basically, the story is that if you get the salespeople really engaged and have them drive plug-in electric vehicles, they will become evangelists, and they will feel willing and interested in spending the extra time it takes to go over with the customer what they need to have to buy an electric vehicle because they are so good.
Yeah, awesome. No, yeah, I wish I could take the rest of the show to talk about this. We technically are over time, but you made a couple really in our email exchange before the show. You made a couple really interesting comments about Elon Musk. So I was wondering if you could just shoehorn that cautionary tale about necessarily being a fanboy of Elon Musk personally, not necessarily the Tesla brand.
Right. So I guess I'd written in that Tesla has an amazing brand, and the challenge that it and the Elon Musk are going to face is that they aren't always living up to the brand expectations. It's kind of one of these situations where, when you're growing up, you don't always want to meet your idols, your heroes, because they don't live up to what your imagination is. Elon Musk has had some excellent business dealings, and he has done some things which are wonderful for the progressive and environmentally interested community. But he is ultimately on his own side. It happens to coincide in some cases with the progressive interest, like I personally have. But in another case, for example, right now, he's embroiled in a bit of a Twitter war with an employee who talked about unionizing their California plant. And he kind of went off and said that this employee was like a UAW, United Auto Workers agent, or paid by them. Really not the kind of thing that you'd expect or want from a progressive champion, which is just kind of you want to reiterate that it's great to be a fan of electric vehicles. But whoever your hero is, it's not good to, wait for, you'll be waiting for Godot or waiting for the Messiah or waiting for your hero to save you. It's not that. It's like, it's everyone doing their own work. All these anonymous people who never get any credit, who ultimately help social movements and, technology changes happen. We just don't want to, we don't want to get carried away in our admiration for people who have done wonderful things, because sometimes those wonderful things might, run against our preferences as opposed to with our preferences.
All right. Well, I appreciate your comments. And of course, everything you talked about, including some of those links about Elon Musk, will be available on the show post after the program. You check that out at greenmajority.ca. Thank you again, Matthew, so much for your time and for your expertise on these issues.
You're absolutely welcome. And I look forward to hearing the show with the after show later this afternoon.
Oh, we're going to have some fun. Don't you worry. Thanks again, Matthew. All right.
Yep.
And now I'm going to pass it over. We're going to find out what we're going to listen to.
Hi, it's Kai again, and we're going to be listening to Swimmer.
All right. We are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, our wonderful community radio partners all the way across the country and into the United States as well, and our international podcast listeners as well as Rabble.ca, National Observer, and all the other good independent media folks that are out there doing good work and providing additional points of view that we then comment on. they do the hard work. We just, you know, have fun with it. I ate up a good portion of your time, Sabina. I do apologize. I'm going to go right to you now. Go ahead.
Thank you, Darren. So I'm going to kind of try to cover a little bit of Stefan's 208-part series on ways to fight. So there was two articles today that I'm going to be covering, and one of them was from The Guardian, and it talks about... So this Guardian article is about the last stand, water protectors return to Standing Rock as drilling set to begin. So I know that we've covered the Dakota Access Pipeline a couple of times, or more than a couple of times on this show, but one of Donald Trump's first acts as president was a presidential memorandum to expedite the Dakota Access Pipeline, and thus on Wednesday, the Army Corps formally granted the pipeline the final permit it required to drill under the Missouri River. And the spokesperson for the company said that we plan on on drilling immediately. And The Guardian writes that a lot of people have returned in order to fight this and huddled inside tents, teepees, and other shelters scattered throughout camps near the construction site. Indigenous and environmental activists on Wednesday said that they would not give up their battle despite the government's aggressive efforts to greenlight construction. So many of these water protectors have returned to fight the $3.7 billion pipeline, and they're currently planning demonstrations, prayer walks, and other resistant efforts. However, Trump, who according to The Guardian has invested in Energy Transfer Partners and receives donations from the corporation's CEO, ordered the Army Corps to cancel the lengthy environmental review and fast-track the permit. This also means that this week's announcement, the corporation, as I said, may start drilling immediately. And a lot of the people that are at Standing Rock right now, they feel really cheated, hurt, and afraid. And this is why right now is one of the biggest times to show support. One of the comments from Messia Bursiaga Hamid, who is one of the water protectors there, says, "I feel like I've made a commitment to the land and the water, and I found a lot of soul family here. This is about our safety in this country as people of color and as people of indigenous to the land. If the water gets sick, everybody gets sick." And I think it's really important not to lose sight of the fight at this moment, and especially because there could be legal battles to be fought here. And I hope that us as the public and people start to really fight against this and show our support.
Yeah. I think it's easy to lose our sight on something like this, especially when it feels like it's already lost. I think to some extent, you know, it's very easy to be like, all right, well, you know, dust your hands up, lost that battle, what's the next one? Especially when we're not being the ones directly impacted by any shape or form. You know, especially, you know, us here in Toronto, or even much of Canada, to be honest, aren't the ones going to feel if this one river or watershed even gets polluted, it's not going to affect us. So it's very easy to sort of be like, all right, well, you know, we could have won that battle, but lost it because Trump got elected, so let's move on. But I think you're right. It's that kind of attitude comes from a place of our own privilege to avoid that conversation. And it should be understood that these are the things we have to be doing now. This is what resistance looks like to some extent.
Yeah, and I think a really another important thing to note is that this is, you know, we're not going to spend a bunch of time Obama bashing, but this is one of the things Obama got wrong, right? Which is that he wanted that appearance of bipartisanship, and he refused to acknowledge the obvious truth. And it's not obvious truth because I'm saying it is. I'm saying it's the obvious truth because the Republicans said that's what they were going to do, which was stonewall everything. And this is the situation we see with ourselves, with the current administration and the oil companies, and frankly, you know, unfortunately, 51% of the voters a lot of the time, is that they've made up their minds and they're not going to waver, right? So if you keep seeding fights, right, because you think you can't win them, you're just saying that if we get pushed hard enough, they'll back off, right? If you push them hard enough, they'll back off. If we push them back hard enough, we'll back off. And one of the interesting things to note is that the Women's March and the movement surrounding it was immediately compared, even by the mainstream media. I think the mainstream media might be in the first to make this comparison to the Tea Tea Party and say, ah, the left now has a Tea Party. Do you know why? First of all, it should be noted that the Tea Party is a tiny, minuscule dot in the ocean of the actual number of people compared to the progressive movement that's supporting things like the Women's March and the opposition to Trump. But the reason they had so much power for such a disproportionately tiny number of people is because they never ceded and they never gave up. And it doesn't matter if it took years. They complained and complained and complained and complained. And they eventually got like 15 senators elected. They got all sorts of policy. They had people coming out and doing their bidding. Why? Because they never, ever, ever backed down. And that's the lesson we need to learn.
Yeah, and they fought the small battles. Yeah, that was like they weren't just, you know, they showed up to these rallies, but they were also sort of fighting these sort of much smaller little pieces that did the different things. But sorry, Sabina, please carry on.
Yeah, so basically, not only are these types of projects. I think one of the main things here to note is that it shouldn't be so easy for a political for a government to just completely change huge infrastructure projects, because this is a project that will not only last during Trump's presidency, this will last for a really long time, and that environmental degradation will last a lot longer than Trump is in office. So I think that these types of large infrastructure projects should have a mandated environmental protection, environmental assessment, and it should go for as long as possible. And there should be no executive presidential order, because this will not only last through his presidency.
Yeah, and you're looking at it's the timelines are all, we've talked about this, about the timelines of environmental projects versus not is always difficult.
And I think something similar here in Canada, the Tsilhqot'in Nation is fighting a battle against the Taseko Mines, who have been relentless in pursuing a $1.5 billion open pit copper and gold mining development in the Cariboo region. So the provincial government actually approved this development in 2010, but it was shut down by the federal government, partly because of the fight that the First Nation community was holding. And one of the main reasons for this disapproval of the project was because of the environmental impact assessment, and because the mining company wanted to drain Fish Lake, who is very large and supports a lot of wildlife, and wanted to turn this into a tailing pond. So this exploration would include a 50-person work camp, 367 test pits, 47 hectares of new disturbance roadblocks, and seismic line testing. And this is adamantly opposed by the Tsilhqot'in. And in January, a letter by the chief, Russell Myers Ross, asked why the province would consider approving more drilling and damage for a project that cannot be built. And so it was really interesting, this article by D Small Canada, because Taseko has been playing with the government of BC, saying that this is BC territory. Why should you let the federal government overturn your approval of this economic prosperity type of development that's going to include $5.5 billion increase in revenues and 71,000 jobs? Always the same type of arguments. It's kind of economy versus the environment. And really what I would love to see is where these two things come together, and the environment, the economy is part of our environment. And if you turn this Fish Lake into a tailing pond, then that's going to destroy so much land.
Yeah, just really quickly, people get wowed by big numbers really easily. But when we're talking about like federal level things, all of the numbers are big. So don't let a billion or a million or any of those numbers, that shouldn't be your trigger. Second of all, whenever somebody's talking about numbers and they're using big numbers like that in this sort of a context, and they don't mention the other side of the equation, they're probably trying to deceive you, right? So what do I mean by that? Well, someone say, well, you know, like we're going to create, you know, 300 jobs by this pipeline, and you hate jobs because you're against the pipeline. Well, what else would, if you're not building the pipeline, what would you have done? How many jobs would that have created? What is the relative? What is the average income of those employees? What is the actual economic benefit? If they've not given you any of that information, they're probably trying to deceive you.
And this is just another example of economic, quote unquote, prosperity against First Nations rights. And I think seeing this, for example, what's been happening is that Taseko Mines has been lobbying to the provincial government in order to continue this project. And the Tsilkotin national government has been saying that we're talking to the federal government, and that's why we're trying to oppose this decision. And it really all goes back to what we keep talking about, the environmental impact assessment, how that should be quantified. If the only world we live in is that economic quantification equal is above all, maybe we should go past this intrinsic value and no, we don't want to quantify these trees and waters and everything, but we should put a value on them and say, look, this value has... is a lot more than your 71,000 jobs. I don't know where these jobs are coming from. If it's a 50-man
mine
project.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think the other thing here that is sort of so commonly missed in this conversation is when you're talking about this sort of relationship between sort of indigenous peoples and their land and the federal government, everything like that, is that the agreement we have is to treat them as their own nation. That is the agreement that's set up. And so while earlier I was more than – while earlier I pointed out the importance of some extent understanding that politicians can be acting in fear and that can lead to sort of not great statements or statements that might be misunderstood or misconstrued in some ways or maybe just like seen in a more negative light than they were intended to be. I also think it's important to understand what they're doing because that's what actually matters. And so especially on the indigenous file, the Trudeau government has been hammered because it's the epitome of their nice talk, no action kind of space. And if you're going to say that you're going to repair the damages of our colonial history, you have to then also actually take action to do that, or else it's the same thing as nice tweets. It's not a action until you do something, and it's these sort of projects in which the federal government has the ability to stand up and help and truly treat these indigenous perspectives as a nation-to-nation deal.
Yeah, I just want to throw in really quickly because I just confirmed yesterday, actually, Stefan, we will be having Bear Standing Tall, also known in Toronto as Rocky Carter, who's the owner and operator of Bear Standing Tall and Associates, coming into the program on March 3rd. So that'll be very interesting. He provides a number of services for his business, one of which I've heard him describe as essentially like how to talk to First Nations people. And at first blush, to some folks, that may seem sort of like a funny statement. But the reason it's very critical is because decision making in First Nations communities operates very differently. And if you're not aware of these sort of cultural nuances, you can frequently, even with the best of intentions, do anywhere from unproductive all the way down to offensive. And so if we're really looking forward to move forward, and both from the environment movement as working with First Nations folks as partners, or as the government or as a company trying to engage with these, I think all listeners will find that interview very valuable. I just wanted to flag that was confirmed yesterday.
Yeah. I think it's also really important to understand that in matters such as sustainability or trying to be environmentally responsible, people have to understand that not everybody speaks the same language as them. If you come from a scientific background, no one is going to care about your background unless you're able to talk about it in a way that's relevant to others. And if you're trying to have a partnership with First Nations communities, they're not going to care about your numbers and your things. Like, they want to know how this partnership is going to mutually benefit them, if it is even.
Well, and then also there's a level of protecting the land, because that's the land they're living on and have lived on for centuries. And so it's one thing, there's a level of short-term thinking that comes to, we can create 70,000 jobs. That 70,000 jobs, even if it exists, only exists for at best, that helps that one generation, sure, but there's the seven generations concept, which just is not a part of economic, economic thinking is one quarter, which is three months. This is a totally different time scale of conversation. And so unless you're having this conversation from a base need of time scales, you're talking past each other.
Yeah, it makes me think of that old episode, Stefan. I think we ended up calling Just Move. I don't know if you remember that one, but it was basically like that idea, which was, you know, what are you guys stupid? We're offering you a bunch of money. It's like, yeah, but we're actually thinking beyond the next 5 minutes. And it's not just like, I think it's often perceived as, stupid First Nations people, they don't understand that with this money they could do X. And really, it's actually the other way around. They're thinking beyond, you know, they're thinking farther out than the end of their noses. And that's how they're coming to these decisions. And some First Nations communities do decide that it's in their best interests, and some don't. But at the end of the day, those decisions have to be respected.
And I think it's important that a lot of the times when these proposals go through, they're proposals that go through from the company to the government or to whoever it is that they need to do this proposal to, and they overestimate the economic benefits, and they underestimate the environmental non-benefits. For example, there's been lots of news articles that say that the oil sands tailing ponds and mining tailing ponds emit toxins to the atmosphere at much higher levels than it's reported, and a lot of these toxins are carcinogens. So that's another thing that you have to think about. Other than environmental or social, it's also the health of the people and generations to come.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That's it for the Green Majority main program. If you're listening to the podcast, we'll be right back with the bonus show where I'm going to talk about the loss of jobs as we know it, the onslaught of mechanization of the workforce. If you can download that at greenmajority.ca or on iTunes. But that's it, folks. Have a good Green Week. Thanks so much for listening, and take care.